Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, July 30th. I'm your reader, Lori Blatchford. Here's our first story. On the middle of the front page, we have a very large photo of some young men in baseball jerseys celebrating, shirts untucked, baseball hats on backwards, mouths wide open, arms in the air. And the title of this little photo section, there are two photos, that's one of them, is Christened in Carroll. Photos by Tom Knapp for the Nonpareil. St. Albert players celebrate post-game after beating Lansing Key in the state 1A state baseball tournament championship game at Merchants Park in Carroll on Thursday. The other photo is of St. Albert's Eric Mathai rearing back with a pitch against Lansing Key, and information that St. Albert won the game 7-5. And there will be that there's an article in sports, which we will get to later in this broadcast. Also on the front page, Vorthman is West Fair Queen, by Mike Brownlee of the Nonpareil. Ashley Vorthman grew up going to West Fair, showing animals through 4-H while also admiring the Queen contestants who put themselves through the rigor of the annual contest and spent the rest of the fair doling out ribbons to various fair champions. Now she's on the other side, giving out ribbons while also still showing animals herself. Vorthman was named West Fair Queen on Wednesday night, beating out a talented group of 9 other young women. Quote, I'm really excited and extremely happy and a little proud of myself. It's good when hard work pays off, said Vorthman, who lives just outside Trainer and will be a senior at Trainer High School in the fall. I've always looked up to the girls who've done it in the past. A lot of friends and family members encourage me to do it. I've always had a passion for being at West Fair. Pearl Huddle, a 2021 Tri-Center High School graduate, was runner-up, followed by second runner-up Sarah Hudgel, a senior to be at Trainer High School. Trainer graduate Stella Umphreys was named Miss Congeniality, while Underwood senior to be Sierra Fox was named Miss Citizenship. Quote, it was a tough decision for the judges this year. We had a great group, said Annie Peterson, Queen Contest Coordinator. Peterson said it was great to hold the contest after last year was canceled because of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was so exciting, she said. The atmosphere, you can feel it. The vibrancy and buzz and the nervousness. It was a wonderful group of candidates this year, all very active in their communities. It really went really well, and it was really warm, but it was good. Vorthman, the daughter of Kelby and Jennifer Vorthman, said of winning, to be honest, I didn't really expect it at first. I thought this year I might just learn the ropes, she said. It's exciting. And now she'll compete for the title of Iowa State Fair Queen. Vorthman is a member of the Silver Keg Feeders 4-H Club and has been in 4-H for 8 years. When she's not handing out ribbons this West Fair, she'll be showing off livestock. Vorthman showed her sheep on Thursday and will show market hogs, breeding heifers and feeding calves today, and market cattle on Saturday. She's also participating in apple pie baking on Sunday, while on Wednesday she showed off her static project, which is agriculture-focused. After high school, Vorthman plans to attend Northwest Missouri State, where she'll study agriculture science with a focus on ag business and animal science. But for now, she's enjoying her crown and all that West Fair has to offer. Quote, it really is a dream. I've always looked up to the past queens, she said. It's very exciting now. I get to be that person little girls are looking up to. Reynolds again urges vaccinations. Governor calls new CDC guidance counterproductive. This is from the Gazette Des Moines Bureau, Dateline Des Moines. Governor Kim Reynolds on Wednesday again urged Iowans to get vaccinated as the best defense against COVID-19 and its variants, but expressed frustration with changing federal mask guidelines she said are counterproductive to conveying a consistent message. Speaking to reporters, the governor said she has not seen data to support the new guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, recommending that even vaccinated people who live in communities with elevated transmission rates again wear masks indoors. Many, but not all, counties in Iowa are rated as having substantial or high rates of virus transmission. According to state data released Wednesday, Iowa has seen an average of 308 new COVID-19 cases a day. Over the last week, the highest it has been in over 2 months. As of Wednesday, the last day of available data, the state reports COVID numbers weekly now. Pottawatomie County was at a 17.9% 7-day positivity rate and 11.5% 14-day positivity rate, according to state public health data at coronavirus.iowa.gov. The site showed that 32% of positive cases over the previous 7 days were among 18 to 29-year-olds. Reynolds said that new cases have been similar regardless of whether the states have mask mandates. "It's frustrating," she said. "It's confusing. They're sending mixed messages constantly. They're telling Americans and Iowans if you get a vaccine, you don't have to wear a mask. And then 2 weeks later, they change the message on that. I think it's contradictory. I think it sets us back in what we're trying to do with encouraging people to get vaccinated," Reynolds said. "I don't feel that we should punish everybody because some have made the decision not to." CDC data indicates nearly half of Iowa's 99 counties are facing substantial or high COVID-19 spread. Over 1 million people are expected to attend the Iowa State Fair next month, where there will be no mask or vaccine requirements. Quote, "We're telling people to get vaccinated first and foremost. I've been very clear about that," Reynolds said. "That is the best defense to COVID. Availability is not an issue." Reynolds said Iowa has a pretty good record of 65% of residents, 18 and up, having received at least one shot. In May, Reynolds signed a bill into law that forbids Iowa schools from imposing mask mandates on students and staff, and now says she is concerned that new CDC guidelines will lead to a federal mask mandate for schools. The CDC recommended that students, teachers, and staff mask up in class regardless of vaccine status or level of community spread, but said students nonetheless should be in schools this fall. During his weekly teleconference with Iowa reporters, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, expressed concern over, quote, "these conflicting opinions," quote, end quote, from the CDC that are creating, quote, "reluctance and kind of some negative reaction," end quote. When the CDC issued its new guidance affecting about half the nation's counties, quote, "they don't tell you why," he said. "It'd be good if they would give this data so that's so important backing up, because they don't have the credibility they ought to have," Grassley said. "I don't have any reason not to say they're a credible organization, but that they do use science, and that they do use science, but they sure have poor public relations," end quote. COVID-19 rates a worry as 1 million head for Iowa State Fair, Dateline Des Moines. With coronavirus cases rising throughout Iowa and around the nation, health experts are becoming increasingly worried about next month's Iowa State Fair, which will bring more than 1 million people to Des Moines from around the state, including many from counties with low vaccination rates and increasing prevalence of the disease. Iowa's biggest annual event comes at a time when giant summer events will draw crowds throughout the nation, including in states that are experiencing more virus infections due to low vaccination rates and growth of the Delta variant. They range from the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally in South Dakota to the Minnesota State Fair, which typically draws more than 2 million people. In Iowa, officials have encouraged people to get vaccinated, but the state's Republican-majority legislature and governor have blocked local governments from imposing vaccination or mask requirements, so there will be no limits on who can attend the fair when the event begins its 11-day run on August 12th. Quote, "Unfortunately, our current leadership has turned their back on science and turned their back on what's available to us to fight this pandemic, leaving Iowans struggling against what could be prevented," said Dr. Megan Srinivas, an Iowa-based infectious disease physician nationally recognized for her research, which includes COVID-19. She said people have misconception about being outdoors ensures safety when the virus actually can spread in large, dense crowds, such as state fairs and large concert venues. "Anytime we see a large congregation of people, especially with the mixed vaccine status, we're going to see high risk for transmission and increases in transmission," she said. In addition, the Delta variant is 2 to 3 times more transmissible than prior virus strains, creating an additional risk among fairgoers as they stand in line for food, share condiment dispensers, and hop into carnival rides. Srinivas said. The Iowa State Fair will be in Polk County, where Health Department spokeswoman Nola Agner Davis expressed concern about the state's virus trends and a reluctance to get vaccinated or wear masks. Quote, we know what the numbers say. We know that our cases are going up. We know the trends are going up. What is the safe thing to do when people can't get vaccinated? They need to wear a mask, David said. Asked Wednesday if she was concerned about infections at the Iowa State Fair, Governor Kim Reynolds didn't directly answer, but advised potential fairgoers to get vaccinated and noted most people hospitalized with COVID-19 have not been vaccinated. Quote, so it's a decision that they've made, she said. They've made a calculation on whether or not to do it or not, and so I don't feel that we should punish everybody because some have made the decision not to. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported Wednesday that 49% of Iowans were fully vaccinated, ranking the state 21st in the nation. In at least 18 of Iowa's 99 counties, fewer than 40% of the population is vaccinated, and CDC data shows 35 counties with a high rate of spread and 12 counties with substantial spread of the virus. Iowa also has the 6th lowest testing rates in the nation among states reporting the data, which could make it difficult to pinpoint an outbreak if one occurs. Srivas said she's also concerned by Ragbri, an annual week-long bike ride across Iowa that continues through Saturday, drawing about 15,000 cyclists from around the country to small towns in counties with some of the state's lowest vaccination rates. She called it the, quote, perfect environment for outbreaks to occur, end quote. In South Dakota, the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally is expected to attract over 700,000 people. The event went forward last year amid the pandemic, leading to 463 infections traced among rallygoers. Many health experts labeled the event a super spreader. Cell phone data shows that for 2 weeks in August, the rally turns the normally sleepy city of Sturgis into a travel hub compared to a major U.S. city. The event is scheduled this year for August 6th through 15th. It's sort of a perfect storm for pandemic spread, said Dr. Doug Lehman, a doctor who runs a health clinic in Rapid City, South Dakota. While South Dakota this summer has seen significantly lower case rates compared to last year, local doctors are still worried the massive crowds could lead to a fresh surge. Quote, this year, there's a lot of forces that are coming together to make it potentially worse than last year, said Dr. Jim Buchanan, a retired physician. Only about 37% of people in Meade County, where the rally will be held, have been fully vaccinated, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. In Chicago, the city's top public health officials said Tuesday that she's still comfortable with the four-day Lollapalooza Music Festival, which is set to begin Thursday. Organizers are requiring attendees to show proof of full vaccination or a negative COVID-19 test result. Dr. Allison R. Waddy said Tuesday, people attending all 4 days will have to be tested at least twice. The festival, the city's largest music event, is expected to draw 100,000 people each day to Chicago's Grant Park. Those who are not fully vaccinated must wear face masks when they are attending the festival. The Minnesota State Fair will be back starting August 26th after a one-year hiatus due to the pandemic. It typically draws more than 2 million visitors during its 12-day run, which ends on Labor Day. Nearly all of Minnesota's pandemic restrictions have been lifted, so fair officials don't anticipate daily attendance limits. As things currently stand, masks will not be required for guests, but are strongly encouraged for anyone not fully vaccinated. Proof of vaccination will not be required. Hand sanitizer will be provided at locations throughout the 322-acre fairgrounds in the St. Paul suburb of Falcon Heights. Garth Brooks fans will have a chance to be vaccinated against COVID-19 when the country star performs at Arrowhead Stadium on August 7th. Chiefs President Mark Donovan said Monday the team plans to take every opportunity to offer vaccinations at Arrowhead, the Kansas City Star reported. Also on the front page, 4-H members fill West Fair Thursday to show animals, and we have a photo of smiling young folks who are holding tightly to the heads of sheep and have them in their stance, and the caption reads, Colton Thompson with Lewis Hunting Pioneers shows his sheep. during the West Pottawatomie County Fair on at West Fair on Thursday, and that there are more photos on 3A, which we will get to here right after this article. And the article is by Emily Scheib of the Nonpareil. Dairy, goat, sheep, and poultry were the stars of the show as members of 4-H clubs in the area made their way to the show ring during West Fair in Council Bluffs on Thursday. Shane Tarks, with the Hazel Dells Challengers 4-H Club, showed his sheep and said he loves the fair. Tarks has been in 4-H for 7 years, but this is his third year showing animals. "We get the sheep around February and take care of them," Tarks said. "We get a different sheep every year." There were more than 60 sheep entries this year. This is year two in 4-H for Gatlin Greiner. She shows swine and does sewing and visual arts as well. "It takes about 3 months to get ready for showing," Greiner said. "You have to put in the dedication and work with the swine every night." Also available at the fair is the carnival, food and drinks, a kids' zone, outdoor games, and more. Today, for the 4-H portion of the fair, swine will be shown at 7:30 a.m., rabbits will be shown at 8:30 a.m., and the breeding heifer, cow-calf, and bucket-calf show will be at 3 o'clock. Arena shows begin today with the tractor pull at 6 p.m., figure 8 races on Saturday at 7 p.m., and the demolition derby will be Sunday at 7 p.m. The fair runs through Sunday. And on page 3, under the title 4-H'ers in Action at West Fair 2021, we have this caption. Rylan Peterson pets a heifer during West Fair on Thursday. Shelby Vorthman with Silver Cake Feeders prepares her sheep to be shown. Eli Yoakum with Silver Cake Feeders shows her sheep. That's Ellie Yoakum with Silver Keg Feeders shows her sheep, and then also Caitlin Greiner sprays water on her pigs to cool them from the heat at West Fair. All right. Also on that page, fired Iowa Veterans Home leader kept excess pay audit finds. Governor Kim Reynolds fired the leader of Iowa's state-run nursing home for veterans in May after learning he had overpaid by $90,000 over a nearly two-year period, a state audit reported Thursday. Iowa Veterans Home Commandant Timon Oriki Okwiri told Governor's Office representatives in May that he was long aware of payroll errors that improperly boosted his salary by nearly $950 per week, but that he kept receiving the excess pay, the report said. Okiri, 63, said he noticed the overpayments shortly after they began in July 2019, but did nothing to resolve the issue, the report said. By the summer of 2020, he said he definitely noticed he was still being overpaid, but he was too embarrassed to report the problem at that point. The governor fired Okiri, who had been commandant since 2017, the next day, and her office reported the financial irregularities to the state auditor. Reynolds' spokesman, Pat Garrett, said Thursday that the governor's office was working with the attorney general's office to recover any overpayment Okiri received during his employment. The report issued by state auditor Rob Sand said Okiri received $90,000 in excess salary payments and that the state incurred another $15,000 in improper retirement and insurance benefits payments for him from July 2019 through April. The report shed light on what had been a surprise and unexplained firing. Reynolds appeared with Okiri at a news conference in December to praise the outstanding job he and his staff had done running the Veterans Home, which is Iowa's largest nursing home, during the COVID coronavirus pandemic. In May, Garrett told reporters that Okiri had been abruptly relieved of his duties as commandant, but he didn't say why. State officials refused to pay Okiri $11,625 for unused vacation that he was owed when he was fired and credited that amount to a partial repayment. That leaves nearly $94,000 in improper reimbursements, including $14,000 in retirement account contributions, that the Iowa Veterans Home is trying to recover, the audit found. Department of Administrative Services employees identified the excess payments to Okiri in April while reviewing payroll information for accuracy before switching to a new system. They found that the problems began in July 2019 when salaried department directors, elected officials, and board members were supposed to change the defaults on their timesheets from 56 hours to 40 hours per week, while DAS officials sent an email to state agencies instructing them of the change. Iowa Veterans Home Payroll Assistance reported that they didn't recall receiving it and the email wasn't sent to Okiri, the report said. The state changed Okiri's default hours to 40, but the Iowa Veterans Home staff responsible for entering his hours in the system overrode the change every pay period and added in 56, the report said. The result was that Okiri got a 43% pay hike beginning in July 2019 that increased his annual salary to $172,681.60, far more than the maximum $128,890 salary that he knew was allowed for the job, the report said. His pay was $948.50 per week higher than his authorized salary over the next year, and that increased to $957.57 per week in July 2020. Okiri was the only person affected by the payroll change at the Iowa Veterans Home, and the audit found that he was the only state official who received unauthorized increase in pay. Okiri has not responded to messages seeking comment since May, and he declined to speak to auditors and Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation agents looking into the matter, according to the report. Sand sent his report to county prosecutors in Des Moines and Marshalltown, where the Veterans Home is located. So far, Okiri has not been charged. On Monday, the governor appointed former Marine Corps official Matthew Peterson as the new commandant of the home, which houses more than 500 veterans and spouses and has 900 employees. Hog dealer fires Iowa-based employees over buying violations. This by Ryan Foley of the Associated Press, Dateline, Iowa City. An influential hog dealer, sanctioned twice for defrauding pork producers out of hundreds of thousands of dollars, says it has fired employees responsible for its latest violations and paid restitution to affected sellers. Lynch Livestock, based in Waccoma, Iowa, also announced that pork industry veteran Dan Sutherland would lead the company going forward, quote, as a further safeguard against future violations, end quote, citing Sutherland's experience in compliance matters. Lynch announced those moves in a press conference posted online Wednesday after the Associated Press reported that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had taken enforcement action against the company for illegal buying practices for the second time since 2017. The company's longtime owner, Gary Lynch, a top booster of Iowa State Athletics and political donor to Iowa Republican elected officials, hasn't returned messages seeking comment. In a press release, his company said the USDA received a complaint in January that employees at its Waccoma buying station were manipulating the scales and issuing false tickets to artificially lower payments to producers. Lynch said it investigated the allegations and terminated an unspecified number of employees who engaged in those practices. Quote, although this situation arose during the actions of a few employees at one buying station, we take this matter very seriously. Gary Lynch, age 74, was quoted as saying, we have already made great strides in establishing new processes and procedures to empower employees and ensure producers receive fair compensation. The USDA said its investigation found the practices went on for 3 years, from January 2018 through 2020. The agency ordered Lynch Livestock to pay $445,626 in penalties and restitution, and to stop recording false weights, altering clarifications of hogs delivered, and creating false scale tickets. The company said restitution has already been sent to producers who were underpaid for their hogs. The USDA had ordered Lynch to pay a fine and restitution and stop the same practices in 2017, after an investigation found the company, quote, willfully violated, end quote, the Packers and Stockyards Act. The company employees arbitrarily lowered weights for delivered hogs, downgraded their classifications, fictitiously claimed dead hogs to lower prices, and created false scale tickets to back up altered weights. The USDA has resolved more than 100 legal actions against businesses and individuals for alleged fair trade violations in the livestock industry in the last 5 years. Lynch Livestock and meat giant JBS USA are the only companies that have faced sanctions twice during that period, according to data on its website. The USDA has not revoked Lynch's dealer license and praised the company in a press release last week for its cooperation and voluntary corrective actions. The company operates 39 buying stations across 8 Midwestern states and markets hogs to major packing plants across the country. Gary Lynch's brother, John Lynch, has alleged in a wrongful termination lawsuit that he discovered weighing and sorting violations in April 2017 and was fired almost immediately after reporting them to company executives. Gary Lynch then reported the irregularities to the USDA, which launched its investigation. In its press release, the company said it had recently, quote, established an internal whistleblower process, end quote, to allow employees to report violations without retaliation. Gary Lynch expressed confidence that positive changes will be made under Sutherland, who spent decades as an executive at Johnsonville Sausage. Quote, we expect Dan will not only help us move forward with these initiatives, but also help Lynch Livestock innovate further in this area, he said. The company did not publicize another change to its corporate structure. On July 15th, 2 days after signing the USDA consent order, Gary Lynch filed paperwork with the Iowa Secretary of State to change the company's name to Lynch Family Companies, Inc. The same day, a new Lynch Livestock was incorporated. In weather for the weekend, this is compiled by Mike Brownlee of the Nonpareil staff. There's a good chance of rain today. The National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska predicts a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms during the day, with the chance climbing to 70% overnight into Saturday. The high today is 86 with a low around 69. The rain is set to continue on Saturday morning and early afternoon with a 50% chance before 1 p.m. The high will be 81 with a low of 63. In more detail, the forecast for today, a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorm, areas of smoke, partly cloudy with a high near 86, east winds 6 to 10 miles per hour, new rainfall amounts of less than a tenth of an inch. Expect higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. Tonight, showers and thunderstorms likely, mainly after 1 p.m. Some of the storms could produce heavy rainfall. Areas of smoke, cloudy with a low around 69 degrees. East wind 7 to 10 miles per hour, chance of precipitation 70%. New rainfall amounts between 1 and 2 inches are possible. Saturday, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms before 1 p.m. Partly sunny with a high near 81. North-northeast winds 6 to 8 miles per hour. New rainfall amounts between a quarter and a half inch are possible. Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 63. Sunday, sunny with a high near 82. Sunday night, clear with a low around 60. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All materials heard on IRIS are intended solely for the use of the blind and the print disabled. My name is Lori Blatchford, and I'm your reader today. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And next we'll turn to today's obituary page. We have one local obituary today, and then a couple of celebrity notices as well that I'll read. Elizabeth J. Betty Blanchard, March 21st, 1932 to July 23rd, 2021. Preceded in death by husband Marion E. Blanchard and granddaughter Sherry Owens. Survived by children Dwayne with Pam, Daryl, Dennis with Lisa, Deanne Blanchard, Doreen Witsky with Dwayne Bain, Denise Hartley with Mark, many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, brothers, sisters, and other loving family members. The family will receive friends Friday, today, from 5 o'clock until 7 o'clock at the West Center Chapel. Funeral will be Saturday, July 31st, at 10:30 a.m. at West Central Chapel. Interment at Cedar Lawn Cemetery in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Memorials are suggested to the Alzheimer's Association. Youth Olympics athlete dies after training accident, from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Havana, Cuba. Youth Olympics hammer thrower Elgany Osorio has died from head injuries sustained in a training accident, the Cuban National Sports Institute said Thursday. The 19-year-old Osorio was struck by a hammer at a track and field club in Cuba in April. She placed fourth in the girls' event at the 2018 Buenos Aires Youth Olympics and took bronze at the Pan American Under 20 Championships 2 years ago. Jean-Pierre Hawk, ex-head of UN Refugee Agency, dies at 83. This is from the Associated Press and Dateline Berlin. Jean-Pierre Hawk, a Swiss humanitarian official who headed the United Nations Refugee Agency in the late 1980s, has died. The agency reported on Thursday. He was 83 years old. Ex-U.S. Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming dies after bike accident. This from the Associated Press with a dateline of Gillette, Wyoming. Retired Senator Mike Enzi, a Wyoming Republican known as a consensus builder in an increasingly polarized Washington, has died after he broke his neck in a bicycle accident. He was 77 years old. Enzo died peacefully Monday, surrounded by family and friends, a former spokesman said. He had been hospitalized with a broken neck and ribs for 3 days following a bicycle accident near Gillette. He was stabilized before being flown to a hospital in Colorado, but remained unconscious. Enzo fell near his home at 8:30 p.m. Friday, family friend John Daly said. Around the same time, Gillette police received a report of a man lying unresponsive on the road near a bicycle. Police have said no indication that anyone else was nearby or involved in the accident. And then, with a caption from a 1982 file photo, Ron Popeil, the man behind late-night rapid-fire television commercials that sell everything from Mr. Microphone to the Pocket Fisherman to the classic Vegematic, sits surrounded by his wares in his office in Beverly Hills, California. Popeil, the quintessential TV pitchman and inventor known to generations of viewers for hawking products including the Vegematic, the Chop-O-Matic, Mr. Microphone, and the Showtime Rotisserie and Barbecue, died on Wednesday, his family said. He was 86 years old. Today in sports, the big story is about St. Albert baseball. And this is from the Class 1A State Baseball Tournament. There is a really large picture of young men in their white pinstripe baseball uniforms with an S and A intertwined on the chest. Baseball hats, backwards arms in the air, index fingers raised in the air in celebration, holding a trophy overhead, and also a banner that reads 2021 Class 1A Baseball State Champion. And the caption reads, St. Albert Baseball celebrates after winning state title against Lansing Key in the Class 1A State Baseball Tournament Championship at Merchants Park in Carroll on Thursday. St. Albert won the game 7-5. And the headline says simply, Champions. St. Albert wins first state baseball championship in 22 years with 7-5 victory over Lansing Key. The St. Albert Falcons are the Class 1A state baseball champions. In its first state championship appearance since 1999, St. Albert scored its 7 runs in the first 4 innings and held off Lansing Key's late rally to win 7-5. Quote, this is exactly why we play, Falcons coach, head coach Duncan Patterson said. To be the last team playing and the last team to get a win in their final game, end quote. St. Albert raced out to a 7-1 lead through 4 innings and held on down the stretch for the win. After going through 3 different Falcon pitchers, Key plated 4 runs in the top of the 6th to make things interesting. Patterson turned to his son, Cy, to get the game's final five outs. Quote, "Coach just came over to me and just said, finish it," Cy Patterson said. "I went out and did my best. Key capitalized on a couple of our mistakes and we really put up a fight, but we found a way to get it done." With one on and two outs in the top of the seventh, Patterson coaxed a can of corn fly out to left fielder Carter White for the game's final out. The Falcons started out hot, striking first, as sophomore Colton Brennan led off with a single and Isaac Sherrill walked on base. Cy Patterson smacked one to deep left center field for a double that brought both runners home. Key threw Patterson out at third as he attempted to turn his hit into a triple. However, the Falcons started the way they wanted. Brennan said, "We just kept doing what we do best. We've been hitting the ball hard all year. We knew we had to repeat that here today, and that's what we did." Brennan finished with a team-high three hits. Notably, he had three hits in all of the state tournament games. After senior Luke Hubbard struck out the first two batters in the top of the second, the Hawks loaded the bases and pushed one run across to cut St. Albert's lead in half. However, the Falcons answered as one run scored off an error and senior Jeff Miller drove one deep near the third baseline for an RBI single to put St. Albert ahead 4-1. Quote, "We knew we just had to stay calm," Hubbard said. "We got a little nonchalant and weren't making some routine plays, but once our coach came out there, he got us all calm again. We just started making plays again and got the job done." Hubbard pitched 5 1/3 innings and struck out 5 batters. Junior Dan McGrath helped the Falcons plate 2 more to make it 6-1 after 3. Another run scored in the bottom of the 4th to make it 7-1 St. Albert after 4 innings. McGrath said, "We kept finding ways to get guys on base. We were able to string hits together and move guys around the bases and bring in some runs. We just kept pounding it and did what we needed to do." McGrath had 2 hits and 2 RBIs. Said Jeff Miller, "This feels like a dream, just an absolute dream. At the beginning of the season, and even from the start 5 years ago, this was our ultimate goal. It's just so amazing, and now it's finally real. We've finally done it." Said senior Brett Klusman, "It's one of the greatest feelings. I love this group of guys that we got here, having my dad, assistant coach Mike Klusman. Coaching also really helped me. He's helped through everything my whole career. He's been a big part of me and baseball. Playing with these seniors was also nothing short of awesome. I love playing with these guys." Klusman and Miller finished the game with 2 hits each for the Falcons. After being part of 2 state tournament teams prior to this year, this St. Albert senior class goes out in a way they and thousands of others dreamed. To go out on top is a dream come true for the successful senior class. "They're ecstatic," Duncan Patterson said. "They've battled over the last 5 years. 2 of them were starters in 8th grade, and they've helped this team. They are true team leaders. To see them go out this way, it doesn't get any better. Again, this is why you play. You get better each year. You get better with each at-bat and better each game, and that's exactly what these seniors did." Said Cy Patterson, "It's such a great feeling. I've been working my tail off since 8th grade for this, and the moment is finally here. It's just such a great feeling to finally accomplish our ultimate goal." Along with a couple of strikeouts on the mound, Patterson had the double and 2 RBIs at the plate. "We're forever state champions. It's truly amazing," Miller said. "I really can't put in any other words. It's a dream come true." The senior class made state in multiple other sports, including football and soccer this year, and was 1 game away in basketball. With this game, Duncan Patterson and St. Albert will remember this group simply as champions. Quote, "There's just so many things about these guys," Duncan Patterson said. "We could go on and on about their accomplishments. I'll remember them on this team for their leadership, their mentality, and how they get after what they want. They wanted this, and now they got it." This is St. Albert's 4th state title game, the first since 1999. The Falcons end their championship season with a record of 35 wins and 8 losses. And on page 2 of sports, we've got a few more photos that I'll read the captions to you. St. Albert, Cy Patterson pitches against Key Lansing in the championship game. And it shows Sai doing a follow-through with his teeth gritted. Also, another photo of a pitcher rearing back to throw. This is St. Albert's Luke Hubbard pitching against Key Lansing, or Lansing Key. And then finally, the photo and the image that's always great to see at state baseball is the St. Albert baseball dog pile after the final out was made in the Lansing Key game in this Class 1A state baseball championship game. Congratulations to those guys. Dressel wins Olympic gold on his own. This is by Beth Harris of the Associated Press with the Dateline of Tokyo. Caleb Dressel tossed his gold medal from a winning relay to a Tokyo Olympics teammate in the stands. He's keeping his second one. Dressel edged defending champion Kyle Chalmers of Australia in a thrilling finish to win the 100-meter freestyle on Thursday and earn his first individual Olympic gold. Quote, "I'm starting to find my groove a little bit," he said. "It's about time, to be honest." He returned in the evening to set an Olympic record in the 100 butterfly heats with a time of 50.39 seconds. After leading off the victorious 4x100 free relay on day two of the Olympics, Dressel watched as his U.S. teammates made repeated trips to the podium. Quote, "I was chomping at the bit," he said. "I wanted to do my part as well." He'll get multiple chances over the final 3 days of swimming. The 24-year-old Floridian will be in the 50 free, the 100 fly, the 4x100 medley relay, and the Olympic debut of the mixed 4x100 medley relay. In all, Dressel could leave Tokyo with 6 medals, which would be 2 short of Michael Phelps' historic 8 golds in 2008. He's been advertised as one of the faces of the Summer Games and a focus of media coverage when he'd rather, quote, just shut up and swim, end quote, as he put it before the Olympics. "Pressure is fine," he said. "It's when you turn it into stress when it becomes a problem." Dressel is always quick to look for the negative in his performances, and he found it in the heats of the 100 free. Quote, "My first swims were rocky," he said. "I was turning the pressure into stress." Minutes before the 100 free final in the ready room off the deck of the Tokyo Aquatic Center, Dressel stared at the Olympic rings on the wall. He's at his second Summer Games and his first since Phelps retired 5 years ago, leaving a void that Dressel quickly filled as the world's dominant male swimmer. He earned 2 relay gold medals at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. At the 2017 World Championships, he won 7 golds and followed up 2 years later by winning 6 golds and 2 silvers. All that was missing was an individual Olympic gold. He went out and got it in the 100 free. His winning time of 47.02 seconds, the fourth fastest ever, was a mere 6 hundredths ahead of Chalmers, who took silver. Dressel sat on the lane rope, signaled number one with both index fingers, his eyes scanning the nearly empty 15,000-seat arena. His teammates cheered the loudest in the stands. Quote, "I just really wanted to take hold of that moment and enjoy it," he said. "I don't want to just surpass any moment because I'm used to it. I don't want to get immune to the feeling that racing offers me." On the podium, Dressel wore a bandana belonging to his late high school mentor around his left wrist. It's the last remnant he has of math teacher Claire McCool, who died in December 2017. He tied the same bandana onto the ribbon of the medals he won at the 2019 World Meet. Dressel got to talk for the first time with his wife Megan and his parents watching back in Florida during the post-race TV interview. Other than exchanging occasional texts with them, Dressel has gone dark on social media and is keeping mostly to himself during the 9 days of competition. Quote, "I'm kind of a loner, a little bit of a weirdo," he said. "I cry a lot. I'm an emotional person. I can't be calling them every night exerting that energy. It's got to be put into swimming." Also on the front page of sports, Olympic gymnastics article, Sunisa Lee takes gold, Dateline Tokyo. Sunisa Lee wanted to quit during quarantine. It had become too much. The lingering pain from a broken foot, the death of 2 family members from COVID-19, her father's slow recovery from an accident that left him paralyzed, the urge eventually passed. It always does. Still, less than 2 months ago, the 18-year-old gymnast hobbled around the podium at the U.S. Championships, getting by more on grit than anything else. Tokyo seemed far away, the top of the Olympic podium even further. Then suddenly, there she was on Thursday night, as the tiniest version of the Star-Spangled Banner echoed across the gymnastics center, gold medal around her neck, a watch party among the Hmong American community in her native Minnesota raging, a victory she never envisioned, not yet sinking in. "It's crazy," Lee said after winning the Olympic all-around title following a tight duel with Brazil's Rebeca Andrade. It doesn't seem like real life. Even though the pain in Lee's foot eased, funny how it seemed to get better the more she trained. She arrived in Japan figuring her best shot was a silver medal. Sure, she'd beaten good friend and reigning Olympic champion Simone Biles during the final day of the U.S. Olympic trials last month, but that was an anomaly, right? Then Biles opted out of the all-around competition to focus on her mental health following an 8-year run atop the sport. Everything was on the table, gold included. Lee took it with a brilliant set on uneven bars, a nervy performance on beam, and a floor exercise that made up for it in execution, what it might have lacked in aggression. Her total of 57.433 points was just enough to top Andrade, who earned the first gymnastics all-around medal by a Latin American athlete, but missed out on gold when she stepped out of bounds twice during her floor routine. Russian gymnast Angelina Melnikova added bronze to the gold she won in the team final. American Jade Carey, who joined the competition after Biles pulled out, finished eighth. Biles' decision to sit out led to a jarring sight of the gymnast considered the greatest of all time, cheering on Lee and the rest of the 24-woman field from the stands with the gold that's been hers for so long in play for everyone else. Still, Lee did her best to not think about the stakes. She FaceTimed with her father, John, who was paralyzed from the chest down during a freak accident in Minnesota just days before the 2019 National Championships. They FaceTimed before the meet, just like always. He told her to relax, so she did, or at least she tried. Lee admitted she was getting in her head a little bit while prepping for her bar routine, the one that's currently the hardest in the world. She didn't exactly look nervous. The 15.300 the judges rewarded her for a series of intricate connections and releases tied Andrade's near-perfect Chang vault for the highest score of the night. Yet, it wasn't Lee's brilliance that made the difference, but her guts. She nearly came off the balance beam while executing a wolf turn, which is basically a seated spin, needed to suction cup her toes to the 4-inch slab of wood to stay on. Her score of 13.833 moved her in front of Andrade heading into the floor exercise. Going first, Lee opted for a routine with 3 tumbling passes instead of 4, hoping better execution would override any potential tenths she surrendered by not doing a fourth pass. Her 13.700 was steady, but it left an opening for Andrade. The 21-year-old Brazilian, 2 years removed from a third surgery to repair a torn ACL in her knee, had the best floor score of contenders during qualifying, yet she bounded out of bounds with both feet at the end of her first tumbling pass, and her right foot stepped off the white mat and onto the surrounding blue carpet. Needing a 13.802 to win, Andrade received a 13.666 instead. Not that she particularly cared. She wasn't even sure she would make it to Tokyo until she won the all-around at the Pan American Championships 2 months ago. She was in tears as she watched her country's flag raised during the Olympic gymnastics ceremony for the first time. Quote, "This medal represents all of Brazil," she said. The gold, however, remains in possession of the Americans. Lee's victory marked the fifth straight by a U.S. woman, with the past 3 Olympic champions all being women of color. Biles and 2012 gold medalist Gabby Douglas are black. Lee's parents are Hmong, an ethnic group who have historically lived in the mountains of Southeast Asia. Lee's parents emigrated from Laos to Minnesota, which has the largest concentration of Hmong in the USA. A large group of friends and family gathered in Minneapolis to watch her make history. She hopes the image of a Hmong standing in front of the world and on top of her sport resonates in a community she sometimes feels can be too restrictive. Quote, "I want people to know that you can reach your dreams and you can just do what you want to do," she said, "because you never know what's going to happen in the end." All right, our final bit in sports today is from the NASCAR page of Racing This Week news. I'll start with a little short article called Odds Are. The latest odds are out after the 22nd race of the season with Kyle Larson, who's second in the standings, favored to win the 2021 NASCAR Cup Series Championship at 9-4. He opened as an 11-1 to win. The long shots to win at 2,000-1 are Anthony Alfredo, Corey LaJoie, Ryan Preece, and Chase Briscoe. The next article says, next, go bowling at the Glen. Watkins Glen International at Watkins Glen's New York will be Sunday at 1 Central Time, August 8th on NBCSN. And this is information about those turns at the Glen. Number one, once drivers take the green flag, they are faced with a downhill trek into the first corner. Carrying a ton of speed down the straightaway, this is a heavy braking zone in order to get the car slowed down enough to make the right-hand turn. This is one of the best opportunities to make a pass, and it can get chaotic quickly, especially on restarts. Turn two, drivers hop on a short straight, which leads them gradually uphill and into the second right-hand corner. Begins the ascent through S's. Turn three, continuing the uphill climb through the S's, this sweeping left-hander can be treacherous as drivers begin to carry some speed up the slope. Number four, drivers complete the uphill climb and the corner starts to level off, building up speed as they enter the backstretch of the road race. Number five, the backstretch allows the driver to gain a ton of momentum, which leads them into another heavy braking zone and into the bus stop or inner loop section of the course. Hot on the brakes upon entry, this is a great place to overtake someone before making a quick series of right and left-hand turns. Lots of slipping and sliding. Referred to as the carousel, drivers approach this long, sweeping right-hander with a banking of 10 degrees, the steepest turn of the road course. It allows drivers to build up speed as they make their way onto the straightaway leading into turn 6. Number 6. Drivers use this turn to either make a quick pass or set themselves up for a pass heading into 7. Number 7. A short shoot gives drivers time to adjust to make a good angle through the final corner. Another chance to make a quality pass as a right-hand bend trickles drivers onto the front stretch and down to the start-finish line. Keselowski is joining Roush Fenway. Roush Fenway Racing and NASCAR champion Brad Keselowski have announced a partnership that will begin in 2022, in which Keselowski will assume an ownership role and serve as head of the team's competition committee while also piloting the team's flagship number 6 Ford Mustang. The partnership pairs one of the most successful organizations in NASCAR history with a perennial NASCAR contender and championship. Quote, "I'm truly excited about this partnership with Brad," said Roush. "I think it will bring a lot to the organization from not only Brad's ability behind the wheel, but a rejuvenation and fresh perspective across our teams. We've had the opportunity to watch Brad for a number of years as he fought and clawed his way up the ladder, molding himself into a champion and one of the top drivers in our sport. I've always admired his resolve and determination. I'm very pleased he has chosen to be part of our organization, and I'm proud to partner with him moving into the future." Roush founded the team in 1988, and it has since become one of the most successful racing operations in the world, propelling him to be the first NASCAR owner to amass 300 wins and capturing 8 championships, including back-to-back NASCAR Cup titles in 2003 and 2004. Quote, "We are thrilled to have Brad on board." said Fenway Sports Group Executive Vice President and Corporate Strategy and General Counsel Ed Weiss. Keselowski has been a consistent contender at NASCAR's highest level for the past decade, having tallied 35 wins in NASCAR Cup Series competition while qualifying for the NASCAR playoffs for 10 consecutive seasons. He led Team Penske to its first NASCAR Cup Series championship in 2012 and has finished inside the top 10 in 8 of the last 10 seasons, including a runner-up finish in 2020. Overall, Keselowski boasts 75 NASCAR wins and has led more than 14,000 laps. I'm thrilled to be able to share the news about this next venture with my fans, peers, and the industry, Keselowski said. This presents an opportunity to continue my on-track success with a strong team and a long-term commitment, but also to dive into my passion of team ownership, where I know I can be an asset to the future of this team. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, July 30th. I'm your reader, Lori Blatchford. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Have a great day.